Royce.
The government says it'll fund 350,000 training and work experience placements to tackle rising youth unemployment. The latest figures show nearly a million young people are not in employment or formal education. The Work and Pensions Secretary, Pat McFadden, said sanction was part of the system and that young people would lose benefits if they didn't engage. Our political correspondent, Billy Kemba, explains what this £820 million package will include.
350,000 young people on universal credit will be given work experience or training in specific sectors, in construction, in the health and social care sector and in hospitality. And a broader group of 900,000 young people will be given intense coaching from work coaches to get back into work. There's also a stick to this policy. The government are saying that if you don't engage with this support, you can have your benefits cut.
A man's been arrested in connection with an assault at Heathrow Airport. Police say there was an argument between two groups of people who knew each other. At one point, pepper spray was used. At least 25 people have died after a fire swept through a nightclub in the Indian state of Goa. Eyewitnesses said around 100 people were on the dance floor at the time. Our reporter Vikas Pandey is at the scene.
This is an area which has a lot of clubs. It also gets a lot of migrant workers from across the country and even in Nepal. That might make the identification process a bit difficult, but officials are telling us that is their next focus. They're also trying to investigate the cause of the fire. Some reports have suggested that it was a gas cylinder blast. They've launched an inquiry and they're looking at a lot of different angles, including if the club had the right permissions to operate and if it had the right number of people that it could allow inside.
Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz has said a two-state solution is the best way to end the conflict in Gaza. He's been meeting Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem to discuss the next stage of the US-led peace plan. Relations between Germany and Israel have been under strain recently, with widespread protests over Israel's conduct of its war against Hamas. And the weather today, a cloudy and windy day, but there may be some brightness in the far northeast. Heavy rain will push north, reaching the far north of Scotland by the evening. Highs of 15 Celsius in London, 14 in Cardiff and 11 in Belfast and Edinburgh. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Chris Beardshaw is a garden and landscape designer who's won 15 gold medals from the Royal Horticultural Society and has enjoyed great success with the Chelsea Flower Show. He was first given some seeds at the age of 4 and, under the no-nonsense eye of his grandmother, soon became fascinated by growing things. He's written several books, including 100 Plants That Almost Changed the World, and he shared his knowledge on everything from his favourite bomb-proof plants to dealing with slugs as a regular panellist on Radio 4's Gardener's Question Time for more than 25 years. Chris, you brought us music by Rodrigo, Max Richter and Carl Jenkins, but we're going to start with Elgar, so why this?
Well, Elgar is such a fundamental part of my childhood. I grew up in rural Worcestershire, almost a land that time forgot. I was a stone's throw from Elgar's birthplace cottage, which is the most quaint red brick building, almost a sort of two up, two down, that just sits with a little pocket garden around it. And just about everything in my early life centred around Elgar. So my primary school and secondary schools both had houses that were named after Elgar. I was a very keen cyclist, and of course Elgar gained much inspiration from cycling around the Malvern Hills. I suppose the most important thing for me is that when I first started work, I came across an old man with a pace table outside on a tiny little lane right next to Elgar's birthplace cottage, and he was selling polyanthus and primulas. And it was the day before Mother's Day, and I was cycling by and I saw these gaudy coloured plants, and I stopped to have a chat with him and started to ask the most obscure questions, really. If you collected the seed from them, would they come true from the colour of the flower and so on? And this old guy, who at the time I was probably 10 or 11 and he was probably in his 50s, but he seemed really old, he said to me, well, you're obviously interested in this sort of thing. if you ever want a job, come back. And so my very first job was working for him immediately behind Elgar's birthplace cottage. And then I graduated as a landscape architect. And my first proper design work was to redesign a part of Elgar's cottage garden. So my whole life, my early life, seems to have been rotating around that little two-up, two-down cottage.
I know it well. Well, I've sat in your garden. What music have you chosen by Elgar?
Well, one of the most important things to me is the way in which music links with landscape and our feeling of landscape. And so the piece I wanted was Weary Wind of the West. And this, for me, encapsulates that sort of spirit of wind blowing through the trees. And it was said, and I don't know how true this is, that this piece of music was originally inspired by the pine trees, the Scots pine trees, which still stand outside the cottage. The wind whistling through the pine needles, which started the inspiration flowing.
You are the Lord.
Weary Wind of the West by Edward Elgar, words by Thomas Brown, performed by the Worcester Cathedral Choir, conducted by Donald Hunt. Do you think that we bring to a composer our knowledge that he lived in a certain place to suggest the landscape, or do you think the music really does sum up that place?
I think from my perspective, whenever I'm designing anything, landscapes, gardens, exhibitions, it's the context which is so influential in informing the design process. And you sit and listen and absorb the character of the space and the energy of the space, and it's that that helps to inform the next design move you make. So I would have thought that Elgar, growing up in that kind of rolling landscape of Worcestershire at the time, it would have felt like almost the end of the world, a million miles from any civilization. And also I think the importance of small fields, copse, the elevation of the Malvern Hills, which is this sort of 9 mile long granite lump that protrudes from the Worcestershire landscape. You know, those are the elements that not only visually, but from an audible perspective would help inform. You know, I can relate to this sort of thing because, you know, I listen to the sound of the wind blowing through the leaves of trees. It's almost possible to navigate a landscape with your eyes closed and know which trees you're walking through because of the sound they make in a particular breeze. So birch is just delicate, just so subtle in the background, and yet beech, with that much more waxy veneer on the leaf, rattles in a rather more aggressive way. Sycamore is deep and heavy. So you can feel the real sense of the tree, the stature of the tree and the physical form of the tree, just by listening to the way that it's responding to the breeze blowing through. And of course, when the leaves descend in autumn, then you have a completely different orchestra of sound as you get the bouncing leaves coming through the canopy and eventually onto the forest floor.
Tell us a little bit more about your grandmother and how she influenced you.
My grandmother was a remarkable character. She left school at 13. Had a very, shall we say, patchy education. She went immediately into service, and I understand that her principal role was cutting flowers from the garden and arranging them in vases for the lady of the house. I don't think she was ever really tutored in that. But she had a real love of flowers and foliage and no interest at all in the pomposity of botanical nomenclature. And so she referred to the plants as, it's the blue one behind the pink one that Auntie Ethel gave me for my birthday. And so she navigated her garden basically on the sort of experiences of how she acquired the plants. She also had a wonderful ability to, in inverted commas, borrow plants, which is a wonderful gardening trait, and cup the bloom or leaf, admire its sort of beauty and form, and then just allow a piece to fall off the plant. And being a tidy gardener, she would then take that cutting and stick it in a pot, or on some occasions in my grandfather's old boots filled with compost, and it would grow. She just had green fingers. She was the person who gave me a packet of seeds for my fourth birthday, a seed tray and a little yellow elephant watering can. And she encouraged me to sow these seeds. And of course, as a young boy, scattered them onto damp tissue paper and watched them all germinate. Every single one germinated. And I thought I was the best person in the world at this. And of course, the great move was that she selected mustard and cress as the seeds to give me, knowing that if you buy a packet of mustard and cress and you put it in your pocket and you walk home and it's drizzling, it's germinated by the time you get home. You know, that is the whole point. Give somebody a plant that they will succeed at, because then they become emboldened by that experience. And that's how it started for me.
From mustard and cress, you moved on to trees.
Yeah. Every weekend we would go up. There's a place on the south end of Malvern Hills called Gullet Quarry. And we'd climb up and walk along the top. And in order to get onto the top, you have to walk up through some really quite dense woodland. I remember walking up in autumn, kicking the leaves, but then seeing acorns germinating and filling my pockets. And my parents gave me an area behind the garage and just said, well, there you go, just have a go at planting things there, which I did. And they succeeded. And my parents, even though they've moved, still have one of the very first trees that I planted in that first garden at the age of five.
Next music is by Einaudi.
Yeah, this again takes me right back to my childhood. I had a very free-range childhood. You know, if you've read Cider with Rosie with Laurie Lee, that's pretty much encapsulating the spirit of my childhood.
So you were an organic creature.
We roamed across fields, we climbed trees, we fell into streams, we played with animals, we worked, in inverted commas, on farms. And I spent so much time by myself in landscapes. And this piece of music, Petrichor, takes me back to nesting in a field of wheat in summer, listening to the energy and buoyancy of skylarks, whose urgency of song is just so dramatic, and listening to a storm blowing in and that gentle pitter-patter of the rain coming through the crop, and the smell, the fragrance, of course, the petrichor, as the rainwater hits not only warm, dusty, salty child skin, but also the clay soil that the crop is growing in. So petrichor for me perfectly encapsulates a summer's day in childhood.
Thank you.
Petrichor, composed, performed and conducted by Ludovico Einaudi, with Daniel Hope playing the violin. I do see what you mean about that storm just gradually coming in and the music getting more and more animated.
And the piano marking time. Mm. It's creating almost a grandfather clock ticking. Mm. And underneath all of that, that sort of sense of urgency and vibrancy, almost the inevitability, that's a perfect encapsulation of the energy and urgency of flora and fauna making their way through a summer's day, achieving as much as they can before the storm sets in or before nightfall.
Chris Mitchell, did you hear much music as a family when you were young? Was there music in the background?
There was always music. My father is an interesting character. He wasn't tutored in music, but came from a very working class background, ended up singing in a choir, and the local vicar noted that he had musical ability and taught him to play the church organ. And so as a teenager, my father was playing the church organ, and all through my life, and in fact still, my father has keyboard and synthesizers, and his escape is still to go upstairs in their cottage and play his keyboard. And he's the most fantastic musician. So I was exposed to it, but not really tutored in it. And unfortunately, I was also, my music teachers at school showed absolutely no interest in teaching music, which always struck me as being slightly odd. You know, they would talk to two or three people in the class who came with a musical skill, but there was no effort to try and engage anybody who perhaps could have benefited from that exposure.
That's very sad. Did you fare well at school otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I left school with a satchel load of O-levels. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to grow plants before I'd even taken my exams. I knew that I wanted to go to Pershore College of Horticulture, which at the time was the world's premium horticulture college, much to the disappointment of my careers teacher. I remember going and sitting in his office and dust particles being highlit by the sort of sun coming in through this high window in his office, and a big leather chair, and I was sitting on a little tiny hard school chair opposite. And he said, Beardshaw, so what do you want to do? And I explained I wanted to go to horticulture. And he said, what do you want to do farming for? And I said, no, horticulture, because that's different to farming. And he said, no, Navy, that's what you should join, the Navy. And he tried to enrol me in the Submariners, but I explained there was no hanging baskets on submarines, and so I peddled my own way.
But as you said, you also befriended a local gardener.
Yes, it was a guy called Archie Waugh, who was the retired postmaster, and he was the person who tutored me. And pretty much until I was in my early 20s, he died when I was about 21, he was the person who took the time to explain to me what was happening with the plants. So I went and worked at his nursery, both as a schoolboy and then after I'd left school. And whenever there was a plant doing anything unusual, a flower bud forming or roots forming or fruit burgeoning, he would take me away from the other lads who were working in the nursery and say, Chris, come and have a look at this. And we'd spend minutes looking at that particular plant, and he'd explain the theory of it. For instance, for a whole day, he taught me how to water cyclamen. You imagine that? Somebody taking you to one side and saying, so a cyclamen corm requires tepid water and it requires the water coming up from the bottom, never water the top of the crown. And he was the person that taught me how to look at plants and how to interrogate plants and gave me that enthusiasm to grow and not be afraid to just try things.
You've chosen a piece by the Spanish composer Rodrigo next. He was inspired by the gardens of Aranjuez.
This piece, for me, there's a real sort of dichotomy to it. On one hand, yes, the story is that it is inspired by those gardens, which are themselves composed of classical and Renaissance references and that kind of pomp and self-grandeur, the sort of celebration of achievement of humankind. And it was also a conversation between the composer, who I understand had recently been bereaved, and this lone voice sitting in a garden of such majesty and pomposity, and the lone voice almost saying, but why? What is all this about? What is the point of all of this if you don't have the love of the people around you? So on one hand, I can picture that when I listen to it. But on the other hand, this is really important to me because this particular piece is played by the Grimthorpe Colliery Band. My great-great-grandfather was the bandmaster at Colebrookdale brass band, which is better known really as Iron Bridge, this sort of valley of industry in the West Midlands. And three generations of the family were involved in that band. And he was bandmaster for 40 years. And my father still has the silver watch engraved and presented to him in 1902 on his retirement. And so this piece of music takes me to landscape, but also reminds me of the very earthy, industrial, hard toil that was undertaken by so many people, whether you were in the mines or whether you were working in industry. I mean, my family were metal bashers. But the emotional release created by playing the instruments and the beauty that was created by these hard men, and yet you have this sort of delicacy and refinement in the music. I just think it's beautiful.
Thank you.
The Adagio from the Concierto de Aranjuez, composed by Rodrigo and performed by Mark Walters, playing the flugelhorn, and the Grimethorpe Colliery Band. I was thinking as we were listening to that music, Chris, how extraordinary that you take a piece for guitar and put it on a colliery band, and it's so, so successful. It's a bit like putting plants in a kind of foreign soil, isn't it?
Very much so. We get so tuned at following a particular pattern or path, something that is tried and tested, and sometimes the most tangential move will allow a complete reassessment of, you know, in my world, plants or the creation of space or the emotional connection with an arrangement of planting. And I think the same is true with this piece of music. You can still hear that there is an element of the guitar and the sort of Hispanic...
Yeah, exactly,
behind it. But it just seems so perfectly delivered by a brass band.
You went to the University of Gloucestershire after Pershore to learn about landscape gardening. So what made you want to go there and find out about that in particular?
That's a really interesting question, because my whole focus was really about growing plants. It was about cultivating them so that everyone was perfect. And if you talk to a nursery worker, thousands of plants, they want them all to be identical. But it occurred to me when I was in my sort of mid to late teens in the little retail area of the nursery I was working in, I started to arrange collections of plants. And initially, the person who owned the nursery said, this isn't going to work. You know, they just need to be in straight lines of one type. And I said, no, just watch the way people behave when you compose plants and choreograph them and watch how they then purchase those plants. And he said to me, well, we'll give it a day. And if we haven't sold more than my way, it goes back to my way. And we were absolutely sold out by the end of the day. And for me, that was a great reminder that growing plants to individual perfection is one thing, but choreographing those plants to provoke an emotional reaction in the viewer is something entirely different. And as a consequence, I thought, well, actually, landscape architecture is the perfect direction to go in, because it is about horticulture, it is about the environment and landscape, but it is also about composition.
What's your next piece?
This is On the Nature of Daylight, and this is Max Richter, who I've seen on several occasions. This piece perfectly encapsulates the design process. For me, it's a potent cocktail of sadness, of happiness, of inspiration. I like this repetition. I think repetition is so important, but it's repetition with change, transformative repetition. And that allows you to drift into spaces where perhaps you hadn't envisaged you were headed. And I think that it's the perfect piece of music for me to play loud through the headphones with a pencil or a graphite stick, a blank piece of paper, and the design process becomes fluid. It's a lucid and freeing environment that's created as a consequence of being absorbed by this piece.
Thank you. On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter and performed by Louisa Fuller and friends. A lot of your music, Chris Beardshaw, has a kind of filmic quality to it. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think the world that I live in is creating visible spaces. And so it's almost inevitable that when I see a landscape or a moment or a cloudscape, the music starts to flow and form. And when I listen to a piece of music, I'm trying to find the landscape that it may be associated with. So the two are joined together. I mean, that's an interesting piece of music because it has a certain discord to it. I find myself sitting on the edge of the seat. You know, some pieces that you listen to, there's a relaxation and a comfort and a reassurance. You listen to it unquestioningly. Whereas with that particular piece, I find myself almost sort of poised to do something. You know, there's a certain kind of coiled spring about it.
Chris, you returned to Pershore College to teach, and while you were there, the Sun newspaper got in touch to say that they wanted to sponsor a garden at Chelsea, and you were roped in.
Yeah. So there was a great gardener called Peter Seabrook, who for many, many years was the gardening journalist on the Sun. He was great friends with my vice principal when I was a lecturer at Pershore College. And the Sun sponsored a series of gardens. Somebody dropped out and my vice principal came wandering into the staff room and said, there's £500, that was the total budget, to design and create a garden with students at Chelsea Flower Show. Anyone interested? And I was a new member of staff and I made the mistake of not stepping backwards fast enough. And as a consequence, I got the job. And it was a delight because we were using students that didn't expect to be at Chelsea. I didn't expect to be exhibiting at Chelsea. We had minimal budget. We had no resources. We had to beg, borrow and steal. And we ended up creating a garden, which was a recreation of a wartime garden, a sort of dig for victory garden. And whilst we were just finishing the build, I turned round and there was a Chelsea pensioner in floods of tears. And he was looking at the garden and the details that we'd put into it. And he said to me, this takes me back to my childhood. This is the garden of my mother. And it's such a powerful thing, the ability for that garden space to connect on that deeply emotional level with somebody. That's what we're striving for.
You had an infestation of whitefly. How did you overcome that?
Yeah, we did. Because we were growing plants in all manner of ways and, you know, using any available space, we wanted some runner beans. And we were growing the runner beans. And when we arrived down at the show, we pulled the back up of the vehicle and clouds of whitefly came out. And you can't possibly take plants infested with whitefly into the world's most prestigious horticulture show. I mean, you'd never be allowed in again. And so we closed the door on the back of the van, waited until it had almost got dark. Everyone else had gone home and we put the beans into the middle of our garden and we went looking in the skips around the showground. And in those days, anything that wasn't being used was put in a skip. And we found some calendulas, the pot marigold, that wonderful sort of sunny, bright, yellowy-orange summer flower. And we arranged them around the bottom of our runner beans and walked out for the evening. And of course, the beauty of those is that they are attractors for whitefly. So when we went back in the morning, the whitefly were infesting the calendula. We put the calendula back in the skip and we had show-winning runner beans.
Well, that's a good tip for all of us as well. Well, it's music by an Icelandic composer next, Johan Johansson, who tragically died aged 48. He took the Orpheus myth as his inspiration for this piece. How does it speak to you?
So Flight from the City is the epitome of minimalist simplicity. It's meditative. And as I was walking through Battersea Park, I had a whole sequence of music on shuffle. And I was walking into Chelsea Flower Show at dawn, which is when we're allowed inside to start building. As the sun was rising, the mist was lying heavy on the grass, and this piece of music came on. And it struck me that because of the simplicity of it and because of the pattern and repetition, I could hear my own breathing so much more profoundly. And it's almost as if you can hear the earth breathing as a consequence of listening to this piece of music. And I remember walking past a bench and there was a fox curled up on the bench. So calm. As I approached, it just opened its mouth and yawned. And there was the breath of dawn as I was listening to this piece of music, and I just thought, what a perfect way to start the day, to engage with nature and set the mind at peace before going into the melee of creating a show garden.
Of Flight from the City, composed and performed by Johan Johansson and friends. Chris, your first Chelsea Garden as an independent designer was in 2006, and it was a recreation of a house in Dorset.
Yeah, this is an important project. We were filming, actually, a series for the BBC, and I came across a house which is called Bovaridge House, a 1920s creation. The architect was Guy Dauber, but nobody really knew who the garden was done by, although there was evidence of a formal garden being present. And the head teacher there was the most extraordinary, irrepressible character. The school was a school for children with really severe social and learning disabilities. And Leslie, the head teacher, just had the most wonderful connectivity with those children. And she gave them opportunities to learn and to interact and to grow. She celebrated the individuality of difference rather than trying to shoehorn difference into a pigeonhole, which is perhaps the conventional educational approach. And the garden needed restoring. We needed some funds to raise money to restore it. And I rather glibly one afternoon, as we were walking around the garden, said to Leslie, the head teacher, of course, we could take it to Chelsea. And she just looked at me and said, well, over to you then.
I think the garden had originally been the work of Gertrude Jekyll.
Well, there's a rather lovely story about that. And the family who originally owned the house in the 1920s, the wife claimed until the day she died that she had created the garden. And that seemed somewhat implausible because the garden was just full of the most delicious elements. The confidence with which it was laid out, it didn't look like the work of an amateur who hadn't had a garden or gardening experience previously. We eventually found out that the overall landscape was laid out by Thomas Mawson, the most wonderful. He's the sort of godfather of landscape architecture, if you like. The sort of design principles that we use today are based on the writings of Thomas Mawson. And Thomas Mawson was from a lower class, you know, the lower social classes employed him. His great competitor was Edwin Lutyens. And of course, Edwin Lutyens is linked with Gertrude Jekyll. The two of them worked together. And because Thomas Mawson had created the master plan, there is no way Gertrude Jekyll would ever have got into bed with Thomas Mawson's design. And so we think that the original owner of the house basically lied to Gertrude Jekyll and said that she had created the master plan. Gertrude Jekyll created the planting plans, sent them back to the owner of the house, who never said anything about the doyen of horticulture being employed to craft the garden. And so what emerged is this truly unique example of a garden created by the best creator of horticultural space with a wash of horticultural planting by Gertrude Jekyll over the top. Never was that repeated. And the two of them didn't know that the other party was involved.
You took a student from the school to Chelsea when you went with that garden.
Yeah, that's a really rather lovely story. The procedure at Chelsea Flower Show is that once the show is finished, on Royal Day, you're allowed normally two members of the garden team who stand on the front of the garden as the royal party come round. And you're generally briefed as to whether the royals are likely to make a visit to your garden or not. And we weren't scheduled to have a visit. So we were sort of tucked slightly around the corner. And Daniel, this young character from Bovridge School, saw Prince Philip get out of the limo. And he started to jump up and down and wave and shout and cheer. And Prince Philip turned round and deviated from the official route, which created absolute mayhem. And he came to the garden, and at one point we had the entire royal party standing on our garden, and in the middle was Daniel. And Daniel was telling the royals about his garden, and the buoyancy that that gave Daniel for the rest of his time at Bovridge was just extraordinary. He always spoke about Prince Philip coming to his garden and talking to him. And as a consequence, the whole school got invited to Highgrove. That's the joy of gardens, is that they connect on so many different levels. They're not judgmental. That's why we do it.
Folk music next.
Yeah, so this is Johnny Flynn with the theme from The Detectorists, and it's a beautiful programme. It's delicate, it's polite, it's a uniquely humble sort of British series. It could only be a British series. And the music tells the story of the finds that come out, whether it's buttons or bottles, every step in a landscape. There's a story to tell. Generations of people have engaged with it in so many different ways.
Will you search through the lonely earth for me? Climb through the briar and bramble. I'll be your treasure. I felt the touch of the kings and the breath of the wind. I knew the call of all the songbirds. They sang all the wrong words. I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you. all along the ocean's floor. I'll be your treasure. I'm with the ghosts of the men who can never sing again. There's a place, follow me, where a love lost at sea is waiting for you, is waiting for you.
The Detectorists theme, composed and performed by Johnny Flynn, who not so long ago was a guest on this programme.
Oh, he's an embarrassingly talented individual. Everything he touches just seems to resonate with quality.
You're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3, where my guest is the garden designer, Chris Beardshaw. In 2017, your Chelsea garden was inspired by music, and I imagine patterns came into that.
Yeah, so we did a lovely piece of work with the National Youth Orchestra. We were fortunate enough to speak with many of the players and go and witness performances. And we were looking to see if there was a similarity between the way in which gardens and plants are created and orchestrated and the way in which music is orchestrated. And so we developed a garden which was telling the story of rhythm and pattern and the richness of music, and played the music, which was composed and played by the NYO, back to the garden. So that was a sort of interesting experiment, really, as to would the two have a dialogue? Would there be a connect?
And was there?
Well, I felt that there was. I mean, I think that there is a massive similarity in the creation of soundscape and the creation of landscape.
Well, this next piece by Garth Stevenson, I think, reminds you of the building blocks of design.
Yeah, I mean, this is a wonderful piece of music. It has a real energy and force. It has a tension. It's a reminder that everything in our landscape, everything in the external environment, is held as a consequence of energy and tension. And what I love about it is that this piece of music is stimulated by taking the instrument back into the landscape. So for me, it's a perfect example of, in a way, reconsidering the building blocks of how we go about stimulating design and not being afraid to try something very different.
Yes, because Garth was inspired to write this music after a trip to Antarctica with his double bass, where he imitated the call of the Sai whales and drew them to the ship that he was on.
Oh, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that the sound of a musical instrument, I mean, a bass is really something to behold, you know, the power and resonance, the vibrational qualities of it. It has an unfiltered rawness to it. You listen to the sound of the whales starting to sweep in. So you've got the music of nature. And, you know, you could argue that the music that we play is directly descended from our experiences of hearing nature and natural patterns.
Thank you.
Part of the Southern Sea by Garth Stevenson from his 2011 album Flying. Chris, I'm fascinated that somebody who's so attached to the land and the soil is also such a keen diver.
So I started scuba diving when I was maybe in my mid-20s, dived all over the world and a lot around the UK. And one of the most relaxing elements of diving is if you get in on a current, it's just an in-breath and an out-breath which allows you to adjust your level in the water. There's no other effort. It's just breathing. And the current just pushes you along cliffs. And as warm and cool currents blend at the interface with a cliff, you get this sort of turbulence and you can just drift for miles. I was doing a drift dive, in fact, in southern Egypt many years ago. We went in just before dawn and the sun was just starting to rise and you had those sort of wonderful shafts of sunlight coming through the water. And because it's very still and the purity of the water, I mean, it's gin clear, sort of flicks and flashes of sunlight on vegetation and the animals, the landscape under the water. And I was with a group of divers and the current was pushing us along. And I turned round and there was a shoal, the most enormous shoal of fish, about 50 metres off the cliff. And I found myself floating in a seated position in the middle of these fish, just breathing. And I got to the point where I dropped off. I nodded off because it was so relaxing. And the fish are all around the mask. And if you don't move, they'll come up and swim within touching distance. And they're sort of just curious about everything, the bubbles and so on. But you're not moving. It's just breathing. And that falling asleep in a shoal of fish at that moment when the sun is just emerging is fantastic. And it's that that really inspires the next piece, which is called The Waves.
The Waves, composed and performed by Gabriel Olafs with the violinist Viktor Ori Aronason and the Reykjavik Orchestra from his 2025 album, Polar. He's only 27 years old.
A most extraordinary composer, and I know winning many accolades. And that's such a powerful piece of music. It says so much with such simplicity. And it has a sort of implied majesty which demands your attention, which I think is very appropriate given the subject matter of oceans and waves. Certainly when I'm diving and imagine pieces like that, it's a reminder of our own mortality and our vulnerability in an alien environment, the delicacy of life, but also the way in which we effortlessly move through water when we're diving or swimming. So there's a real contrast between that implication of power and respect and the fact that we have the delicacy of movement and fluidity.
You're a familiar voice on Gardner's Question Time. What's the biggest challenge when trying to help listeners with their gardening woes?
It's normally the fact that they only tell you part of the story. You know, it could be a couple sitting in the audience and one of them will ask a question about why a tree has miraculously died. It was fine on a Saturday, but by Sunday it was dead. What could possibly have caused it? And we try all of the horticultural routes and come up with no solutions. And invariably it turns out that it was the other half who's been perhaps strimming or badly pruning or using weed killer or whatever it is. You know, that people are very filtered, perhaps, with the information that they give you. It's a lovely programme and has such a reputational following, loyal listeners, some of whom don't have gardens, but they just like the sound of gardeners talking about gardens and the joy that that brings, the enthusiasm that gardeners have, the optimism. You have to be optimistic to be a gardener.
We do have a biodiversity crisis in the UK, birds, insects. Can gardeners make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, if you add up all of the area of domestic gardens in the UK, it outweighs the landmass of all of our national parks. So that gives you a sense of...
That's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, the power that gardeners have, if we can convince people to just subtly change the way that they garden. Sometimes it's just allowing, for instance, leaves to fall in autumn. Just let them sit on the soil. Don't rake them up and have this sort of fanatical tidying process. Allow them to sit on the ground. And that will enable and activate macro and microorganisms which draw those leaves into the ground. They'll compost down. The worms travelling up and down and horizontally in the soil will improve aeration and drainage and organic matter, the humic content. So some of the things are so simple. Don't tidy up.
And leaving fallen branches and trees wherever possible, that, of course, is a wonderful source of food for wildlife.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, geriatric trees, as limbs fall off or as the whole canopy dies back, if you allow that dead wood to stand, you'll get beetles and larvae and woodpeckers and owls. And suddenly a tree which is, you know, in the case of an oak tree, several hundred species associated with our common oak tree. But suddenly you'll get an extraordinary increase in the amount of availability and opportunity for other organisms to engage. So, yeah, don't tidy up. Enjoy every stage of life of every plant in your garden.
You've seen this next piece live, I believe. It's The Armed Man by Carl Jenkins.
So, yeah, this piece, very recently, actually, I went to Bath Abbey and witnessed the most wonderful performance by the Full Tone Orchestra. And I love this piece because it's such a simple piece of music. It starts with the cello opening and that basic sort of alternation of the cello, which continues all the way through. And the piece grows and has a sort of confidence. And there's a sort of echoing, haunting conversation between the cello and the rest of the orchestra. And it develops and then almost implodes and descends back to the simplicity of the cello. So growing, blossoming, and then going back.
The Benedictus from The Armed Man, a Mass for Peace, composed and conducted by Carl Jenkins and performed by the cellist Guy Johnson with the National Youth Choir of Great Britain and the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Chris Birchall, did that take you back to sitting in Bath Abbey?
Most definitely. I think the conversation between the cello and the rest of the orchestra and choir, I think is a really important lesson that a single voice on a subject can evoke and provoke a response and a harmony and a community developing and confidence developing. And I think that that's so important in life, that sometimes we become so isolated, we feel as though we're isolated and that our voice doesn't count. And that sort of simple repetition of that cello pattern echoed by others is just phenomenal. And when it all comes together, it's, yeah, very powerful.
Chris Bitcher, what would you say are the biggest changes that you've seen in gardening over the last 25 years?
I think, firstly, it's the number of people who are participating. When I started off, no one knew really what horticulture was unless you were involved in the profession. Garden centres were really just emerging. It was right at the point where nurseries were becoming much more retail orientated. I think we've become much more aware of species diversity and biodiversity, as we mentioned earlier. The fact that there are so many health challenges that can be assisted with exposure to gardens and to landscape. So landscape, in a way, over that period, has moved from being an expression of artistic form, which is something to own, to a process where actually it's about the engagement and the involvement. It's about participation rather than ownership.
You often talk about bomb-proof plants. If you were going to suggest something to grow for first-time gardeners, perhaps beyond cress and mustard, what would it be?
Well, it does depend where you are and what you're trying to achieve, but I would say that the herbaceous geraniums are fabulous. Some of them are semi-evergreen and will persist into, you know, even under snow cover. And they carpet the ground with such enthusiasm. They're very mercurial. They will spread and mould around other plants and loll over the topography of the garden and landscape. So I would say, you know, have a look at those. They're fantastic. In terms of trees, well, birch trees are just beautiful. Betula nigra, the river birch, has the most fabulous, almost shrimp pink peeling bark and loves having its feet, as the name suggests, in a kind of watercourse. Very delicate canopies, filtered light coming through, and is great at multi-stemming.
Tell us about your final piece.
It's a hauntingly beautiful piece. It's so atmospheric and it has a vibrational richness to it, which I think is just delightful.
And of course it's filmic.
And it's filmic, as you quite rightly observed. And the vocalist, Lisa Gerrard, is just mesmeric. And it wasn't until I listened to the piece and then tried to understand what the vocals were saying that I realised that it is in a language of the heart, I think she described it. It's a sort of fabricated language that she developed in childhood. And I don't know whether this is true, but I read that someone had tried to interpret the language and interpret the last few words. And it says, "No one can believe or understand how far I've come just for my lovely family." And anybody who has family and friends, I mean, we have three beautiful girls, will understand the importance of that level of commitment and the joy that family brings.
Well, this is Elysium from the Gladiator soundtrack. Chris Birchall, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Elysium from the Gladiator soundtrack, composed by Klaus Badelt and Hans Zimmer, with vocals performed by Lisa Gerrard with the Lyndhurst Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Greenaway. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the garden and landscape designer Chris Beardshaw. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. It's Christmas around Europe on Radio 3 next Sunday, but Private Passions returns in a fortnight's time when Michael's guest will be the poet Pam Ayres. Her choices include seasonal favourites along with Rachmaninoff and Elgar. That's here on Radio 3 at midday in a fortnight's time.
On BBC Sounds. Ensure all is calm this Christmas with a special festive sleeping forecast.
On Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house.
Wrap yourself in timeless tunes with my Christmas crooners mix. Classics from Bing Crosby to Michael Bublé.
Have a holly jolly Christmas.
And step back with soothing seasonal tracks on the Mindful Mix.
Get all kinds of Christmassy.
Just search Christmas music on BBC Sounds.
At 3 o'clock, a service of choral vespers comes from Arundel Cathedral. But now on Radio 3, Sarah Moore Peach plots a musical course from Star-Crossed Lovers to the members' clubs of Cuba.
Hello, welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we plot a single musical destination within a landscape of connected sounds. Today, our endpoint is the suite of symphonic dances from Leonard Bernstein's groundbreaking musical, West Side Story. So this is the piece we're working towards, and we'll hear all the symphonic dances at the end of today's show. West Side Story is based on Shakespeare's tragedy Romeo and Juliet. So let's begin our map with some other musical settings of that great play.